Okay, so today we're going to talk about a subject that's of extreme importance in understanding the survival of the Jewish people. Obviously, we like to think there are a lot of supernatural forces involved. I mean, one supernatural force in particular. But if we analyze the survival of the Jewish people, we can see that despite its apparently miraculous longevity, the Jewish people did put in place a lot of really significant sociological, maybe even anthropological mechanisms that supported their survival throughout a very difficult diaspora filled with persecution and, on the other hand, threats of assimilation. And much of that success was due to the fact that they worked out a rather excellent communal structure known as the Kehillah. It's an organization that really helped the Jews survive, and in fact, it persists to the present day, not so much in the traditional sense of the term, but at the very least in the organization of synagogues. They adopt, by and large, the exact same structure of the Kehillah as was used in really the ancient period through the medieval up until the early modern period. So let's have a look at the Prezi, and we'll see exactly how that worked. Okay, so here we go. Here's our Prezi, and I'm going to open it up. Okay. Okay. This, by the way, is a rather amazing image. This is of the Wolpa Synagogue in Poland. I chose it just because I wanted to have some kind of communal facility that we could look at. You can see the really interesting Oriental-style pagoda-like architecture that was common for many of these wooden synagogues in Eastern Europe. Many of these synagogues, I'm not sure if the Wolpa Synagogue was included in them, were made entirely without nails, entirely just with natural wood. The reason being Kabbalistic in nature, that nails being metal somehow defile the structure, and so they made it completely out of wood using tongue and groove techniques, really phenomenal works of art. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about them in a later class. But at any rate, let's go to our topic today, which is really Jewish communal structure. So the passage in Pirkei Avot really says it all. If there is no flour, there is no Torah. And if there is no Torah, there is no flour. Meaning, you have to have work in order to engage in spiritual activity. And you have to have spiritual activity in able to continue working. We need both of these things together. And in many ways, the way that the Kehillah was structured was essential to Jewish survival. The Kehillah supported Jewish survival, and with ongoing Jewish survival, there was a perpetuation of the Kehillah structure. This would come crashing to a halt in the 19th century, and in many ways the Jewish world has suffered tremendously as a result of the Kehillah, still trying to figure out exactly how to define its existence after the loss of this institution that lasted close to two millennia. But nevertheless, let's concentrate on the ancient and medieval periods today. The Kehillah survived and was so successful at keeping the Jews intact because there was a tremendous amount of coercion involved in the system. In other words, you had to belong to the Kehillah, and once you belonged to the Kehillah, you had to follow the rules. It's very important that we understand that up until the late 18th century, really, the French Revolution, there was no such thing as a secular Jewish identity. You either belonged to the Jewish community or you belong to another religious community, the Christian or the Muslim community, for example, depending on which culture we're looking at. There was no such thing as saying, you know, I just feel like opting out. I don't feel like belonging to the Jewish community. Now, it's true, as I may have mentioned to you before, the current, you know, inheritors excuse me, of the Kehillah structure would be an institution like, let's say, the United Jewish Appeal or the Federation Movement. And once you get on their mailing list, the only way to get off is through the FBI Witness Protection Program, but that's not true of the ancient period. In the ancient period, the only way to exist was within a corporate structure like the Kehillah, or moving out to a different estate, let's say in a feudal system, like the Christian peasants or the burghers and so on. On the other hand, if the Kehillah is overly coercive, if there is no freedom and no dissemination of power, then the Jewish community would simply dissipate of its own accord, as people would voluntarily elect to leave the community and join the other communities they had to compete with. There was no like middle ground. You were either in or out. And we should remember that the Kehillah, even though it exercised this coercive power to keep the Jews intact, we should view the fact that they did so within the context of an often hostile minority. Tiny Jewish minority living within an overall hostile environment can spell disaster, but the Kehillah was an important mechanism for keeping them alive. This is exemplified in the late 19th century work of Shalom Aleichem, the great Yiddish writer, who wrote, as you can see in this picture here, Tevye der Milchiker, Tevye the Dairyman, popularized in English as Fiddler on the Roof. The idea being that Jews are like violinists perched on the very top of a peaked roof, and they're trying to eke out the tune of their lives. They're trying to play music, all the while balancing precariously on the rooftop. And that was the nature of Jewish life, trying to figure out exactly how to maintain a Jewish existence within a hostile environment, and the Kehillah was one of the most profound balancing factors. Now, if you actually log in and see the Prezi, you can watch this little video of Tevye, where he talks about tradition and things like that. It's really great to watch it, but, you know, actually maybe we should watch it because it's fun. No. We're going to go on. Just go and log into the Prezi, and you'll be able to watch the whole thing properly. We're going to go past this. Okay, sad but true. Okay, so here's the Kehillah, and I've broken it up into several main parts so you can understand the most significant elements of the Kehillah. The first element of the Kehillah, first section, were the so-called Tuvei Ha'ir, or the good people of the city. This was typically an association of five men. Women were not seated on the Tuvei Ha'ir. This is a very androcentric institution. It's also a plutocratic institution, meaning it is dominated by wealthy individuals. The members of the Tuvei Ha'ir were expected, in exchange for the great honor of receiving these leadership positions, they were also expected to essentially write checks to the Jewish community. And so it was kind of give and take. Wealth gave privilege, but at the same time meant responsibility. And quite often, the Tuvei Ha'ir would have to underwrite a lot of the very important work that the Kehillah would do, as we shall see later. The Tuvei Ha'ir would appoint one member who was known as the Parnas, or the president. The word Parnas and president are most likely related, but the Hebrew term Parnas means the one who provides. Lefarnes means to feed, to provide, that kind of thing. And that was a very accurate term because the Tuvei Ha'ir were required to give of their own wealth to keep the society moving. There were periodic elections. People would move in and off of the Tuvei Ha'ir, but this was a standard feature of every Kehillah. Now, the Tuvei Ha'ir was balanced by the Beit Din, typically comprised of three rabbis. The Beit Din were given the task of ensuring that everything that happened within the Kehillah, including the actions of the Tuvei Ha'ir, were entirely within the bounds of Jewish law, of halacha. And this meant that sometimes the Tuvei Ha'ir and the Beit Din would come into conflict, especially because the salaries of the Beit Din were actually paid for by the taxes collected by the Tuvei Ha'ir and often supplemented by the Tuvei Ha'ir's own resources. So if the Beit Din were to be overly strict and demanding of the Tuvei Ha'ir, chances are the Beit Din, or at least part of the members, would simply be fired and they would lose their position. On the other hand, if the Tuvei Ha'ir did not behave in accordance with halakha, as clearly stipulated by the Beit Din, then the large masses, the Jewish population as a whole, would lose their confidence in the Tuvei Ha'ir and exert the kind of soft pressure that would ultimately cause Tuvei Ha'ir members to step out of those leadership roles. So the Beit Din and the Tuvei Ha'ir had kind of like a dynamic relationship of opposition and pressure that kept the whole thing basically running according to Talmudic law and with a fair degree of equity. The Beit Din would also, of course, be adjudicating all kinds of internal disputes as they occurred in the Kehillah, and was an essential aspect of making sure that there was consistency and integrity in all of the legal affairs of the Kehillah. Both the Tuvei Ha'ir and the Beit Din employed people called gabayim. The word legabot in Hebrew means to collect or to enforce, And I kind of like the term enforcer myself. Now, you may have heard this term, the gabbai, from synagogue membership, because there's always someone in the synagogue called the gabbai whose job it is to basically make sure that everything runs properly during the services, that the correct people are called up to the Torah for the readings in the correct order and things like that, which doesn't sound like such a, it's an important task to running the community, but it doesn't sound like such a forceful task with a tremendous amount of authority. The traditional gabbaim, however, were extremely powerful because they were given the task of carrying out the will of the Tuvei Ha'ir and or the Beit Din. In the case of the Tuvei Ha'ir, the most important thing the gabbaim would do was they would collect the taxes. They would have the responsibility of going out and making sure that every member of the kehila paid the required amount as assessed by the Tuvei Ha'ir. And so this is a rather coercive system. It's not like an income tax system where, you know, you fill out your forms and you have appeals and things like that. But the Tuvei Ha'ir would basically have a look at your wealth and say, okay, you have 3 cows this year, so we think you should pay this amount of money. And you would have to surrender it. And if you didn't like it, the gabbaim would come. And if you didn't like that either, well, then you could run into the gabbaim of the Beit Din, which could impose even further sanctions. They could impose fines. They could impose social ostracism, meaning, like, for example, you would lose synagogue privileges, or there would be a proclamation saying people couldn't do business with you for a period of time. Or most seriously, you could lose burial privileges, and we'll talk about that in the next slide. The gabbaim had a tremendous amount of authority because they were acting on the decrees of the Beit Din and or of the Tuvei Ha'ir, and they had a tremendous amount of impact on society. Again, though, the coercive nature of the kehila, although it may rankle modern sensibilities, was essential to keeping the kehila functioning. They had to have standards and consistency and make sure that Jews complied. Well, I should also mention that corporal punishment was not at all unknown. That, for example, let's say a person refused to appear before the Beit Din when summoned on a repeated basis, let's say, then that person could actually receive lashes for failing to comply with the Beit Din's demands. Now, the majority of the work of the kehila, the actual functioning of the kehila, was done by the chevrot, and these were dominated by women. The Tuvei Ha'ir, the Beit Din, the gabbaim, all male, but the chevrot, predominantly female. The word chevra in Hebrew means association or a group of friends, and basically we could translate this term as committees. There were a whole host of committees that were dedicated to serving all the needs of the kehila. Things like taking care of orphans, taking care of widows, taking care of poor brides, taking care of travelers, study associations, you name it. Anything that the kehila wanted to organize, they would create one of these free-form committees, again dominated by women, who would then use some of the resources that were given to them by the Tuvei Ha'ir to make sure that they could carry out their work. So let's say, for example, very common, you have the hachnasat kala, the providing for poor brides. There'd be a certain number of brides in the kehila that did not have sufficient means to set up their first home, and so there would be a chevra, hachnasas kala chevra, that would go to Tuvei Ha'ir, and they would say, all right, we have so many brides this year, we need so much money, and the Tuvei Ha'ir would have to disburse those funds. Ideally, from taxes collected from the large tax base of the kehila as a whole, but more often than not, they would have to actually come out with some of the money from their own pockets. So the chevra would be responsible for carrying out this function within society, and they would rely on the Tuvei Ha'ir to provide them with things. We should also understand that compared to surrounding Muslim or Christian societies, the Jewish level of social service, the social safety net, as it were, was massive. There was very little comparison. The Jews were really very, very self-sufficient as a community, creating all of the various institutions they needed to care for those who are downtrodden within society. The Gabayim, if we can go back for a second and remember these guys, one of their functions was collecting, for example, for the weekly poor relief. As described, for example, in Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, there will be several different funds, one for people who had, you know, not even two meals worth of food to their name, one for people who had like 3 days worth of food, and another, let's say, for people who needed food for the Sabbath, or especially for, Passover. You know, that's, the Gabayim would go out and they would collect all of this money door to door, and then the Chevras would be in charge of dispersing it as appropriate. Now, these are kind of the formal, I forgot to mention, the most important Chevra of all was the so-called Chevra Kadisha, the Holy Chevra. And the Chevra Kadisha, it was a male and a female Chevra, were associated specifically with Jewish burials. Chevra Kadisha was typically populated only by the most respected, typically older members of the community for Kabbalistic reasons, which we won't get into right now. And the Chevra Kadisha had tremendous authority. If they were so commanded by the Beit Din, or in some cases the Tuvayir, the Chevra Kadisha could withhold funeral services from a recalcitrant member of the community. And this was taken very seriously by the communities. The thought of not having a Jewish burial struck fear into the hearts of Kehillah members, and typically even a warning that the Chevra Kadisha would refuse to bury a Jewish member of the Kehillah was sufficient to get them to comply with the standards of the Kehillah as a whole. Now, of all these groups, we should remember that there were a few alternative loci of power, meaning places where you could exercise power. There were a few kind of like disruptive power structures that were tolerated within the Kehillah for special occasions. One of my favorites, for example, is that if a woman felt that she was not being treated well by the Beit Din or the Tuvayir, and she felt that her case was not being considered adequately for whatever reason it would be, she could actually go into the synagogue on the Sabbath morning during the Torah reading. She could invade the men's section and go right up and stand on the bima with the Torah open and refuse to allow the service to continue. Of course, it requires a separation of men and women during traditional services until her case was heard. And this was a huge public embarrassment for the Tuvayir or the Beit Din if they had not been handling her case properly. And it was kind of a threat that many people could use, women could use in particular, to exert their will despite the lack of obvious power. The occasions in which this would typically be exercised is, let's say, for example, if a woman was separated from her husband, and her husband refused to grant her the requisite get, or bill of divorce. The way Jewish law is structured, ultimately divorce only happens when the husband grants the wife a bill of divorce. It's a situation that is extremely dire in the 20th and 21st centuries as divorce rate increased, and that's maybe for something we'll talk about at the end of this course. But it's not an unknown phenomenon throughout Jewish history. Now, if a woman felt that, you know, she was being pressured unfairly, let's say, to have her parents pay off her husband's debts before he would give the get, and they didn't have enough money or things like that, then one of the ways that she could retaliate is simply by going to the synagogue and stopping the services, publicly shaming both her ex-husband, who's actually still married to her but separated, and the holders of real power, the Tuvayir and the Beit Din, into acting more forcefully. And of course, as mentioned, they could use corporal punishment to make sure that the husband gives her the get. So that's kind of like the main structures of the Jewish communal structure. To jump ahead to the 16th and 17th century, all the way really through the 18th century, one of the most fascinating elements of the entire system is when a whole bunch of these kehillas, essentially Jewish municipalities, got together and decided to unite, and they formed something known as the Council of Lands, sometimes called the Council of Four Lands, in which they brought all of the kehillas together into essentially a government within a government, a state within a state that existed in the medieval and early modern Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. They would have meetings twice a year in the market city of Lublin and discuss all kinds of issues that were important to the entire region, including, for example, husbands who run out on their wives without giving a get and they move from one city to another. Well, you know, the kehila system allowed for a level of standardization so that people could not escape their due. They were also quite involved with copyright law. They instituted the so-called haskama because this was coming out around the time that printing was popularized. The haskama that is today called an approbation at the front of a typical traditional religious book will usually say, some rabbi will write a letter saying this book is kosher and it will not pollute your mind if you read it, things like that. But back then, the haskama was designed mainly to enforce copyright, telling readers of the book that they are not allowed to republish this book on their own until a certain point of time has arrived and things like that. They also, kind of interesting, they engaged heavily in sumptuary legislation, which essentially are laws limiting consumption. How so? One of the things that went on in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was that, you know, Jews would make celebrations, simchas, for a circumcision or for a wedding, a bar mitzvah, and there was a significant amount of one-upmanship where if, you know, let's say Reuven made a bar mitzvah and he would serve three kinds of gefilte fish, then when Shimon had to make his bar mitzvah, he would serve at least four kinds of gefilte fish, and then when Levi wanted to make his, even though he had very little money, he couldn't certainly offer less than four kinds because his friend Shimon did that. And, you know, costs skyrocketed and simchas just ballooned out of control. And so the Council of Lands said, okay, from now on, only two kinds of gefilte fish at a bar mitzvah. You cannot invite more than 300 people to a wedding. And they kept on making these laws over and over again, which indicates that people simply weren't paying attention. That despite the highfalutin nature of this really huge gathering, let's say, of kehilot, they still were not paying attention when it came to things like how we're going to run our own simchas. So that's kind of a funny thing. Maybe we'll return to it when we get to the modern period. At any rate, that's the entire story for now of the structure of the kehila. It's we should bear in mind that it was very coercive, that the Tuvayir would assess your taxes and you would have to pay it. You would have tax collectors, the Gabayim, coming. Of course, it was a progressive tax where if you made less money, you had to pay less to the communal funds and so on. But the Tuvayir, with the Beit Din in particular, really helped keep the Jewish people in line and behaving with one basic Talmudic standard of law, which was incredibly important at keeping the Jewish community well-structured and keeping its vitality intact. When we get to the 18th century, we'll see that the destruction of the kehila, which came with the French Revolution of 1789 and in Russia with a formal decree in 1844, for example, this structure ended. And although Jews now had much more freedom in terms of defining their own identities, often secular identities, in contravention to traditional Jewish law and practice, nevertheless, that also opened up the very dangerous avenues to assimilation as Jews simply melted off the sides of the core population. So that's basically it, a quick overview of Jewish communal structure. I hope you found it interesting, and I look forward to talking with you in the next lecture.